The Guardian.
Support for this podcast comes from Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes creating a professional website for your business, personal brand, or portfolio so easy, it's newsworthy. Go to squarespace.com and use the offer Guardian to get 10% off.
Hello, and welcome to Tech Weekly with me, Lee Alexander. On this week's show,
this idea of the digital native is very misleading. Yes, they're quick with their thumbs, but it doesn't mean that they've got all the information about the world out there, the unadulterated adult world out there.
Celebrated filmmaker Baroness Beban-Kidron discusses her iRights manifesto campaign, which sets out to promote digital rights for young people. Also, I'm joined by the tech team to defy sideswipes by Private Eye magazine and talk at length about the newest Apple products, iPad Air 2, iPad Mini 3, and Retina iMac. We've also got the Guardian scoop on the Whisper app. And do you want to be the real Marty McFly? Well, a hoverboard might be winging its way to you soon. This is Tech Weekly from The Guardian. We kick off this week with the happening that was Apple's unveiling of new iPad versions in California.
The original iPad started with an A4 chip, and now we're 12 times faster than that with iPad Air 2. But check out this graphics performance. We're now at 180 times faster.
Phil Schiller was there leading the iPad Air 2 presentation at last week's launch, where we also heard about the next-gen iPad Mini and the 5K iMac. Charles, would you like to tell us some more?
So, as is becoming an annual event, Apple updated its iPads. Last year it had the iPad Air, which is very much thinner than the previous iPads, and had an improvement for the iPad Mini. This year it was just a bit more of the same, except they added Touch ID. The Mac Mini, which is a sort of little headless computer, no screen, no keyboard, it's basically used by a server by a lot of people, got a long overdue update. And Apple also showed off a 5K screen iMac, so it's a top-of-the-range iMac. Very expensive, $2,499.
About
the same sort of pounds, yeah. But it's got an incredible screen. I think it'll be a big favorite among people who want to do work with photos, especially in video editing. And even have some people wondering about not getting a Mac Pro at all. The Mac Pro being sort of the ashtray professional thing, which again you have to find a screen for. And in terms of the pricing of the screen, just on that thing alone, Dell's offering a 5K screen, which costs the same as the whole computer does from Apple. So it's clearly going after the top-end market, but I don't think it's a very big market.
That is, in a sense, the doubling down on the core Apple audience, the high-end design user.
It's keeping them right in there by going with the amazing screen. On the iPads, it's not sort of thrilling. The interesting thing I thought was that they added Touch ID for unlocking it, which people in businesses and enterprises told me was interesting for them because it's great. Because the IT department tells them they have a long password, and they get really sick of putting in the long password. So if you can unlock it with your fingerprint, that's great. It's really good for interacting with customers especially.
Not exactly thrilling does seem to be the watchword of the event, though.
Yeah, that's pretty much it. I mean, and earlier this week, Apple had its financial results where it showed that iPad sales had fallen again. So that's three quarters in a row that they'd fallen year on year. Tim Cook sort of expresses optimism about the future. He sort of suggests that they run down the inventory a bit. But the fact is still that they're just not taking off in the same way. People just don't have a need. People who got them at home, at least, don't have a need to replace them yet. And businesses don't seem to be deploying them in a big way. But Apple has this tie-up with IBM. There could be something come out of that. Could be Touch ID will interest the enterprises more. Maybe there'll be more sales in 2015, or maybe there won't.
Is the Touch ID something that a consumer is going to want to rely on, given the hardware issues that a lot of the Mac models tend to have?
I think for a tablet, I mean, there have been no troubles with them on iPhones, and I think for a tablet...
It's a year in now. It was first introduced with the iPhone 5S last year, and so far we haven't seen much to complain about. People seem quite happy with them. They don't seem to be going defective, so I think it's a pretty sturdy piece of equipment.
Are we at the point now where we think that maybe all of these form factors are combining with cost constraints for consumers, and that might be a challenge to the company?
I think rather than cost constraints, the thing is we're reaching a stage where the form factors are just reaching maturity. You know, the making it thinner is always kind of the last ditch way of reshaping a line. The iPad Air 2 is just the iPad, but slimmer. It doesn't look likely that there'll be any major changes to the model, bar something which I'm sure Sam will want to talk about, if it goes widescreen. It's a mature product, and that's the problem that Charles was talking about. It's a mature product. It was already almost mature at the iPad 1. Certainly by the time of the 2 or 3 when it hit Retina, it was basically finished. Mm. And it's hard to look at an iPad Air 2 and hold up your iPad 3 and really see a compelling reason to buy it. Whereas the 6 compared even just to the iPhone 5, it's bigger. And that alone, for many people, will drive an upgrade. Mm. You've not got that same churn in the iPad thing. And I think that's the real constraint that Apple's going to find.
Interesting.
I mean, the iPads are being bought, and other tablets, are being bought instead of computers. And computers are on a slower refresh cycle. You don't replace a computer every year. Why should you replace a tablet every year? And their capabilities were ahead of their time at the point of purchase. By the time you get 3 years down the line, they still pretty much do exactly what they needed to do now that they did then. I mean, the only thing is more power, and the iPad Air 2 has a considerably faster processor, but most of the apps don't use it. It's only when we get to video processing things. I mean, it showed off some really fancy video processing.
And, of course, gaming.
Yeah, gaming too. But for most people, you know, they browse the internet, it works great. Why bother replacing it?
There's certainly something to be said about the saturation thing. I mean, tablets are now in something like 40% of households in the UK and the US, so they've gone from zero to that level faster than any other piece of equipment, you know, going right back through the century. Even more so than smartphone, even more so than, you know, you name it, electricity, fridges, whatever.
Literally better than
literally,
electricity.
Literally fast, no, faster than, you know. I'm not sure about better than. But, yeah, the saturation thing is huge. And certainly the question of what do you do with it, you know, I tend to think of tablets as sort of fill-in devices. They fill in that space when you don't want to get the laptop out and you don't want to get the desktop out and don't want to get your phone out. And it's, you know, it's a bit bigger than the phone. You know, I think the mini segment, the 7-inch, 8-inch segment, is getting squeezed badly by phablets particularly. But I think there's still life probably in the larger sort of 10-inch ones.
I mean, both myself and Alex read comics on it, on a full-size tablet.
Which it could have been made as a purpose-built comics reading device, and it wouldn't have sold as much, but I'd probably still have bought one.
Interestingly, some of the games I like the best on iPad are interactive reading and really immersive storytelling apps, too. It's a really good device for that experience.
Yeah, it's great. I mean, it's that thing of lean back rather than lean forward. So you are in a different state of mind to how you are playing a PC game. And then compared to a console, it's not that living room filling experience. It puts you in the mood of reading a book, which is a very different headspace.
So do you think we want to see app developers and software developers step up to create more compelling content tailored specifically for the tablet device in order to drive further hardware adoption?
I mean, we've seen iPad magazines, you know, tablet magazines try and basically reinvigorate the losses in print.
I do think, I mean, I've long thought tablet magazines are one of those things which were invented by the journalism industry to save itself rather than invented by the journalism industry to serve customers. I think there are tablet-specific experiences which haven't been explored or haven't been explored as well yet. And it's certainly noticeable that a lot of the apps that aren't built for the iPad that I use right now, things like, say, Tweetbot for iPad or Instapaper for iPad, they are very much these days a secondary thing, tweaking the phone version a bit, but not sitting back and rethinking what it means to look at it on a tablet. Whether that's possible, I don't know. You know, maybe this is yet more wishful thinking, that I'm making tablets into a device more distinct from phones than they actually are. But it does feel like the experience of going through an Instapaper, going through saved articles when I'm in my tablet mode, which is kind of I'm sitting back and wanting to read something, does have different pressures than when I'm standing on a train with no signal wanting to read one of the 6 articles that I've got saved offline.
I definitely feel like there are more applications for tablets and miniature tablets that haven't been fully explored on the app market. Yeah. So is there anything else you want to tell us, Sam, about the Apple launch?
Well, it was an interesting one. For me, the big takeaway was the iPad Mini 2 and Mini 3 balance. So effectively, the new one is the Mini 3, but it is the Mini 2 with Touch ID and in gold. That was the big change.
Sounds like a luxury upgrade if I ever heard of one.
The internals are exactly the same. The screen is exactly the same. The size and everything else is exactly the same. The only difference on the inside is you can get larger storage versions, but the basic model is the iPad Mini 2 with a Touch ID sensor. But what they did was they squeezed the iPad Mini 2 down in price and then squished the iPad Mini even further down. And so they're now targeting a much lower cost bracket. But basically the tablet space currently occupied by the Google Nexus 7, that kind of £200 to £250 range, which is more in the kind of like second tablet space. And it's interesting, Apple's way of doing a cheaper tablet. And
I do love that, like, so the iPad Mini 3 is the iPad Mini 2 in gold with Touch ID for £80 more, which sounds ridiculous. But then I know quite a lot of people who had a black MacBook when that was a thing, which was the white MacBook for £120 more. It was no different from a white MacBook. It was ostensibly the MacBook with the largest hard drive, but you could configure a white one, put a larger hard drive in, and save £120. And yet people paid the extra for the price. And I think some of that is that black was a desirable color then, and maybe in Britain gold isn't as desirable a color, but Apple is going after the East Asian market in a big way. And part of it is that there's quite a lot of people, and I think quite a lot of Apple's core market, who aren't going to cut back, who aren't going to save money. They want the best, and the best is the iPad Mini 3. Yeah.
It's what's known by economists as a Veblen good, where it doesn't matter what the price is, they just want it. Mm-hmm. And but certainly the thing where you say, well, they've done, had a Touch ID and give it a paint job, and made the other one cheaper. Yeah, it's almost as if they knew they were going to have a big phone now, isn't it?
Yeah, it's kind of the 5.5-inch iPhone 6 Plus really is starting to almost steal that chunk. I don't know.
I'd be amazed if it didn't, but I don't think Apple cares.
I think that people used to line up to pay exorbitant prices for Apple products because there were no alternatives. And now that there are plenty of alternatives, such as the Nexus and things, Apple, in a sense, has to double down on being the status-oriented consumer's favorite brand. So let's move along and discuss Whisper, the app that claims to be the, quote, first completely anonymous social media network, end quote. This week, it was found to be not so anonymous. A Guardian scoop by our U.S.-based colleagues Paul Lewis and Dominic Rush learned that the company was collecting location data about users even when they had expressly opted out of its geolocation services. This is a bit of a complicated one. Alex, would you like to tell us some more?
Well, so what happened next is, I should say, Well, so this all came about when The Guardian was invited to Whisper's offices to look at a journalistic collaboration. Dominic and Paul went along to see what Whisper could do for us, because both we and other media organizations have used data from Whisper in the past to write stories. We reported on some Iraq veterans who were sharing their problems on the service, and then sites like BuzzFeed have written things like, I think it's 15 gaming widows of Whisper, aggregating up all of the stories of women complaining about their boyfriends ignoring them for their video games.
Let me pause you right here, because actually this is the first, unfortunately, that I heard of the service was behind this, the eruption of this sort of conversation. So I'm curious as to what exactly people had been using it for, and what were we hoping that The Guardian could do with it?
Well, so the way Whisper works is essentially you have the app and you can choose a picture and write text over it. That's the core of it. And then the rest of the app is just ways that picture gets put in front of people. Now, what you do with that, what you write about it, is kind of at the core of all of this. A lot of people just use it for venting. The whole idea of it is it's unsigned. Every post is anonymous. So if you write, for instance, a photograph of a woman in your bed and write the text over it, "I am cheating on my wife," you hope your wife won't see it, but you get that little frisson of a confessional.
Flirting with risk, even though theoretically your location and name are anonymous.
The heart of it is kind of the same idea as Post Secret, that originally I think it was a newsletter, and then it became a site, and then it became a book. People sending anonymous heartfelt confessions. And it's the idea that other people's anonymous confessions are quite fun to read, and making an anonymous confession yourself can be thrilling, or can be relaxing, or can get something off your chest. The heart of these journalistic collaborations is that actually quite a lot of the time, stuff that people think they can't say in public is almost the definition of what you want to find out as a journalist. So, for instance, some of the collaborations were soldiers. Soldiers often cannot complain at all about their working conditions. So if they go on Whisper to vent, that's news. Similarly, people who are deep inside quite closed businesses might complain. Whisper actually hasn't been big for that, but Secret, another service which does a similar thing, has led to quite a few stories from Silicon Valley, none of which have been particularly accurate. But if someone goes, I work in Apple and I've seen the iPhone 7, oh my God, it's amazing.
And here's a picture that I've uploaded.
Right, the tech press is going to leap on that. Whether or not it's true, for some aspects of the tech press, they don't really care. It's still interesting. So what I think we were hoping to get out of this, and the reason why Dominic and Paul went along, is to see, you know, you can only do so much just using the Whisper app yourself. You can scroll through popular feeds, you can maybe hit up a few random ones, but you're going to need some sort of help from the back end to trawl through thousands of confessional posts to find the ones that are really juicy and newsworthy. So that's what you go along to Whisper to look at. What happened then is essentially Whisper shocked our reporters. They went and they were expecting, I think, to be told something like, oh yeah, well, here's our CMS, which lets you look at thousands of posts rather than just one at a time on an iPhone. And what they were actually told is, okay, well, here we can take a look at posts based on where their location data shows them. We can link together posts based on location data. If someone has opted out of providing the location data on their iPhone, we can look at the IP address it was posted from, which will still tell us information about the city and country they're located in.
And consumers did not believe that the company was storing that information
right. necessarily. Right. If you're posting on the anonymous social network, you expect to be anonymous. So Dominic and Paul saw this, and this was all on the record reporting. Clearly, Whisper didn't expect it to be framed in the way it was, but they absolutely, this was information to be reported. So Dominic and Paul went back, collated it, and then put it to Whisper. And between putting it to Whisper and the story being published, Whisper changed its terms of service. Really quite drastically changed its terms of service to explain to users for the first time, for instance, that their data wasn't just processed in the US, as they'd previously promised, but actually that there is a data center in the Philippines which processes data. To explain more precisely what the location data does, how they use IP addresses. But at the core of the disagreement, it seems to me, is just what personal information means. Whisper say they don't collect personal information, and that therefore any Guardian reporting that says they are collecting personal information must be wrong. What they seem to mean by that is that they don't collect your name. They don't ask for your address. If they don't ask for your name and address, if they don't have it, then by definition, in their minds, you have no personal information.
But your IP address and your approximate location, even if it's, as they say, fuzzed,
exactly,
it still may feel to some users like a violation of their privacy if they were not prepared to divulge that information.
And so Whisper say, you know, we'll fuzz this data to within 500 meters. So for Whisper, a piece of location data which is only accurate to within 500 meters is not personally identifiable. To someone whose house is the only house in a 500 meter area, they might disagree quite strongly. And even actually in quite a busy city, I would be relatively surprised if there was anyone else who lived within 500 meters of my house and works within 500 meters of The Guardian. All I'd need to do is make two posts on Whisper, one from home and one from work, and it wouldn't be that hard for a dedicated employee of Whisper or a journalist working with access to their back-end tools to identify me, to de-anonymize me.
And that was the big thing, was that the conversations as reported by Don Rush and Paul Lewis was that someone said, there's this guy in the DOD, doesn't know that we're tracking him and you know, we'll follow him for forever.
Exactly.
So that was basically the surprise really for Rush and Lewis was you say that it's anonymous and yet actually in the back room you're watching all this. When this all broke, Whisper went ballistic, and there were sort of two parallel threads of the response. One response was, this is not true, and the other response was, this is so unethical for you to come into our company and report all these things.
One of the interesting things that's come out of all of this is saying Whisper went ballistic maybe lacks some of the nuance. What actually happened was Whisper's editor-in-chief, Nietzen Zimmerman, who was formerly, and this is, I believe, his words, or at least Gawker's words, the traffic whore for Gawker.com, who went to join Whisper as, I mean, an editor-in-chief.
Why does an app need an editor-in-chief?
Well, to do precisely what we were talking about, to find the juicy nuggets contained within these anonymous confessions.
And disseminate them, for interest and for promotion of the app.
Exactly. To hook up with BuzzFeed, to hook up with The Guardian, to find the juicy nuggets, to get the stories and to get more people on the app sharing more confessions. It's a great idea. But the problem is, if you hire someone in that job and they then go ballistic and accuse journalists of fabricating quotes, you really have to back that up. And it doesn't seem that Zimmerman was at all. He wasn't actually present in the discussions which he was accusing Rush and Lewis of fabricating quotes. And then his CEO, when he spoke out the day later, didn't actually back up Zimmerman at all. Whisper's CEO in his first statements essentially admitted that our terms of service were unclear beforehand. We changed them to be clearer to users. We think there is a discussion to be had about the nature of anonymity.
And the definition of personal information.
Right. He did still maintain, and this is one thing that Whisper's maintained throughout, that the changing of the terms of service was not related to The Guardian's reporting, that they'd been planning this since July, and that, in effect, it was a huge coincidence that it just happened to occur after The Guardian asked questions and exactly on the questions The Guardian was asking.
Yes,
I do think the parallel thing about the sort of ethical question of, you know, how dare you come into our office and write stories is an interesting one, which hinges actually on the fact that none of the people who went to Whisper had signed an NDA, a non-disclosure agreement, and there's been a lot of discussion about that. Some people have said, well, that's so underhand, but it's sort of what journalists do, especially if they don't sign an NDA, then actually they'll tend to come in, and if they find something which they think there's a public interest in revealing, then actually that's what they will do. And I think it's been very interesting what Paul Carr, who's a former contributor of The Guardian, and who I know personally, has been quite vociferous in Pando Daily, which he co-edits. He's basically picked up the whole ethics question and was running around the whole of Silicon Valley. I mean, he's very hard on a lot of the tech reporting sites over the extent to which they will get into bed, if you like, with technology companies they're meant to be reporting on.
I mean, that's not just the fault of the tech reporting sites. The technology companies are occasionally insanely pushy about the extent to which they will require reporting to be off the record. The best example of which that I've encountered recently is if you turn up to Facebook's London HQ, they have a lovely little completely automated signing in system. You don't have to go up to a receptionist and remember the name of the person you're there to meet. You simply go, type your name in. It checks to see whether you're expected. If you are, it calls up the person and they come down. You've got a name badge printed out. Amazing. You do have a terms of service to sign while you're doing this. And in that terms of service is a non-disclosure agreement. Essentially, if you go to visit Facebook, you are probably not reading a legal agreement which bans you from reporting on Facebook.
Sworn to secrecy before you even enter the building.
Right. Now, I mean, they genuinely make it quite difficult to tell the person you're there to visit that you're there to visit them without signing this non-disclosure agreement. And I would wager that there are a fair few journalists wandering around London and presumably Silicon Valley, I can't imagine this is only in Facebook's London headquarters, who knowingly or not have signed a non-disclosure agreement with Facebook, which would effectively prevent them from doing this sort of reporting if they chanced upon a similar story about Facebook or about Instagram or about WhatsApp.
Well, it seems like in both cases, whether you are a user of technology or a journalist in this situation, the main issue is the lack of transparency about the agreements that you're entering into when you utilize or discuss something. What might the implications of this reporting be for Whisper and other services like this?
I think the implications of the reporting for Whisper itself, it looks increasingly likely is going to suffer more from its reaction to the reporting than the reporting itself. Mm. I think the long-term takeaway for it is that it's a company which is not open and does not react well to criticism. And that's a hard image to shake off. For companies like Whisper, I hope what's going to happen is that customers are going to realize that anonymity is a lot harder to guarantee than it is to say. You have companies like Whisper, like Secret, who say you're anonymous. And what they actually mean is, we don't want your information. That's very different from actually promising anonymity. For that, you need...
We won't save anything. We won't collect anything. We will not utilize anything.
What they're saying is, trust us to keep you anonymous, which is very, very different from you are anonymous. There are services like Tor, which actually offer you anonymity. There are services which have it baked into the code of how this service works the inability to track you down using the information from that service. And that's simply not something that Whisper or that Secret offer. Whisper and Secret are saying, trust us. They're saying, well, look, you can't see the information in the app. It's very difficult for you to see the information that the app is sending. But just look, trust us, we're not tracking you. And I hope that what this will result in is trust us not being good enough. Or at the very least, people who are saying trust us having to explicitly say that, having to be clearer that your anonymity is as strong as your trust in us. It's certainly not absolute.
The nature and protection of anonymity is sure to be an important issue going forward. To keep up to date with any developments on this story and to read more on all things app-related, please go to theguardian.com/technology. Ever since Michael J. Fox took to the air in the 1989 classic Back to the Future Part 2, little and not so little boys and girls have dreamed of jumping on a hoverboard and flying down the street. After lots have tried and failed to bring the magic of the hoverboard from the screen to reality, now a company based in Los Gatos, California, claims to have the real deal, a board that hovers an inch off the deck. Samuel, is it real?
It certainly is. It really is. And this is the first time I've ever been able to say this. I've looked at many of these things, and they've all been either hoaxes or trickeries and bastards. Yes, this is a board that genuinely does hover off the deck, but unfortunately only on certain materials.
How does it work?
So effectively, it's like a mini maglev train, more or less. It's a board that has electromagnets underneath, and it generates a circular current called an eddy current in a conductor, which creates a magnetic repulsion, and presto, you fly about an inch off the surface. But it requires non-ferrous metal
surfaces. So nothing with iron?
No, it has to be something like aluminium or copper.
So I could sort of plaster my house in tin foil and hover around in it.
Oh, yes, that would be amazing.
Wow, the future is coming.
And should.
Yes, definitely. This is created by a company called ArxPax, and they've been working on the technology for a couple of years, and they've just launched a Kickstarter campaign. They're looking for $250,000, which I thought was not a lot, really. But
it doesn't seem like a lot to develop technology that people have tried and failed to create for generations.
They've got the technology ready and a board that actually works. They've been having journalists in to try them out.
Oh, when do you get to go?
Oh, sadly, it's only in the US. Oh. So no London firm yet.
You should hoverboard over there.
Oh, that would be amazing.
I mean, heads up to any startups listening. If you have a hoverboard, we will come to your office. Like, this is the best way to get coverage for your company. Build a hoverboard. We are there in seconds.
Would you like to see our full disclosure anti-anonymity app? By the way, we have hoverboards.
And can I take it home? For a normal person, this is rather expensive. A dev kit, which is effectively the same technology, a floating white box, mm-hmm. Right? So it's designed to kind of like for people to muck around with what they call their electromagnetic engine.
What sort of development could take place using a kit?
Well, I mean, they do a demo. This little box is controlled by a smartphone and will float on a metal surface, and you can steer it with a smartphone app. But I mean, you can do swarm robotics and that kind of thing. You know, it's just a different way of moving your gear about, and that's $300
for the dev kit.
Just the dev kit. If you want the actual board itself, it is $10,000.
So we'll take three then.
And that's not forgetting the cost of tiling the surface that you want to actually board on with metal.
Yes, there is that too. Copper's not exactly cheap. But yeah, I mean, this is the first proof that it can be done. Lots and lots of companies tried and failed.
For $10,000, I'd imagine I can do my full hour commute on the hoverboard, right?
15 minutes. Well, it depends how fast you go. I mean, you know, you're flying through the air here, so there's no friction to deal with.
Battery life.
Yeah, 15 minutes. Well, but it's a start, you know, the current board will support people up to 300 pounds, which is 140 kilos. To put it in perspective, I'm about 83 and I'm a 6'1" man. so 140 kilos is quite a lot. And apparently the tech should support up to 500 pounds.
All three of us could go.
Could sell one.
Yeah. That would be quite. Yeah.
So let's split one among the three of us.
There we go. $3,500 each. That's fine.
Yeah.
And someone can push out the back. It'd be fine.
Strip some wiring from the building to create the metal surface.
Yeah. Oh, don't start about cable thefts. God.
petition TfL just to repave the streets of London in copper. For me, with my hoverboard, I'm sure they'll do it.
And also, copper is a great antibacterial surface. So
clean as well.
It is, yeah.
Floating hygienically through the world in no time.
I can see no reason not to do this. None at all.
They were talking about remaking all surfaces in hospitals with copper. So you can imagine, I mean, this is a proof of concept and you start off with a hoverboard, but they have the idea of basically making those hover beds.
I'm now imagining a hovering surgical gurney and just everything going wrong as it flies out of control with the poor heart transplant patient.
Perhaps you've been reading too many comic books on your tablet. That was a callback.
But, it's great. And there's no real propulsion yet. Maglev trains work by cycling the magnets along the route, but then, of course, they're quite long, so they can do that and still suspend themselves on this thing. But you can effectively induce a little bit of drift. So it's got touch pads on the top, so you lean one way and you spin one way. And apparently it's not that easy to control.
No. The floating $10,000 skateboard is hard to steer. I'm shocked.
So what are the practical applications of such a device besides our fantasies about the 1980s?
Well, as I was saying, basically it's a very efficient way, friction efficient and energy efficient way of moving large objects. It's a bit like going back to the old canal way of transporting stuff, except your instant canal floating, floating stuff on air. It means that you have to have much less force behind it to move it. So yeah, there's lots and lots of benefits I can see, especially in the future.
I like the way you pluralize fantasies about the 1980s, because this is just one.
I have many.
There's so many more we need.
But I'd like to point out that, Marty McFly took to the skies in 2015.
Yep.
We're almost there.
So if people want to consider backing the prototype or learn more about the company, they can look on Kickstarter, or there's a website.
Yeah, indeed. Just fire up Kickstarter and search for the Hendo. The board is called the Hendo and the company is ArxPax.
Sounds great.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace. When it's time to create a website for whatever's newsworthy in your life, whether that's a small business, online store, professional portfolio, or just a blog, go to squarespace.com and use the offer Guardian to get 10% off.
Understanding and retaining rights around digital data can be a complex endeavor for even the most tech-savvy, but for young people born into a digital culture, digital by default, for them it can affect social, educational, and life outcomes. So how do we educate young users on how to understand the nuance around how and what they consume and share online? To help me answer this question, I met up with the founders of the iRights campaign, filmmaker Beben Kidron and digital entrepreneur Guy Fernando.
Welcome to Tech Weekly. How are you?
Very well.
Very
thanks.
Well, thank you.
So we commonly think of today's generation of kids as being incredibly tech savvy, that they're the ones who are going to have to teach us everything there is to know about the world online. But it turns out there's probably a thing or two that they have yet to learn from us. Isn't that right?
I think that's right. I think one always has to sort of separate out the use of technology and the what it's being used for. And I think that this idea of the digital native is very misleading. Yes, they're quick with their thumbs, but it doesn't mean that they've got all the information about, about the world out there, the unadulterated adult world out there. And I think that's something that's misleading for adults and young people.
Yes. In fact, I agree. It's sort of hard to tell now out there on the internet, who's responsible for the content you're consuming and what your rights are in those spaces. So you've decided to try to take the lead on an educational campaign for rights in the digital space. Is that a good way of describing it?
I think so. I mean, when we're feeling grand, we talk about it like as a civil society movement. Mm-hmm. What we feel is there's a whole bunch of us who are really tech positive. Yes. There are people who come at this, like Guy does as an engineer entrepreneur who has his whole life in this space. Right. And there's people like me who come at it from a number of different positions as a filmmaker, communicator, as a mother, as a, you know, as someone who's got a political part of my life. And it just seems that something this important, i.e. the organizing technology of our society, should somehow be designed without children in mind. And I think that's what sort of we're here about. What we're trying to say is, how about designing our new world with young people in mind, with their needs at the forefront? And hey, if we did that, what would it look like? And that's where you get to iRights. This is a bunch of people, 100 or more big organizations with millions of members of different kinds, saying, okay, if we were trying to be good, what would good look like?
So can you explain to us the key issues at hand that you're concerned about when it comes to children's use of online space? And then we can maybe go on to talk a little bit about how you would like to see them addressed.
The key issues are really about the fact that we have a society which has sort of got a sort of a rights-based agenda that is operating in most parts of the world and then is not somehow working in the digital space. So our key problem is that things that already exist, assumptions we already make, are not being reinvented, reimagined for the technology. So this is this kind of like, you know, let's be a bit future-proof and let's admit the world we live in, that on and off is not, you know, there is no real world. There's only this one world. And how do we look to put these rights, you know, in this space? So what we looked at was really, what would a young person maybe benefit from rather than address problems? And I think that's partly what we all feel, is that it was getting into a very, very competitive space about protection on the one hand and freedom on the other. You go, hang on a minute, you know, you don't learn a coherent language, an internet language, a communications language, a technological language, by going, you got to protect or you got to be free. You do it by putting some tools in place and some grammar. And so the grammar looks like the right to remove. So if you put it up, you can take it down. The right to know, which sounds very simple, but is very complex because it has not only about terms and conditions, but about profound understanding of what exchange is on both sides. So no partial knowledge, no abuse of ignorance, you know, no business models that actually absolutely mean that if you want to access it, you can't unless you say yes. You know, all sorts of things around that. Lots, and even knowing whether your parents are listening, frankly. The right to know what the deal is in an age-appropriate way. The right to be safe and comfortable, and for everybody in this space to have roots to kids so they know where to go if they're troubled, out of all kinds of places, even the Guardian website, you know, sort of in places you won't expect where kids happen to be. And then the last two rights are the right for conscious use, which is this whole thing, and you know a lot about this because you're a gamer, but the whole idea of extending use and reward technology, for example. And then the last bit, and I think that maybe we should hand over to Guy for this bit, but digital literacy, to reimagine digital literacy not being about coding or tech, but about the social outcomes of things, about the purposes of people's interactions with you, about the coding language, and about the creativity. And so digital literacy, in the same way as we have philosophy, politics, RE, language, literature, and so on, when we consider English, we look at digital literacy in the round.
On a practical level, what is the implementation going to look like on your end? How are you going to sort of roll this out and inform people and get people informed about these rights and using the manifesto?
I think that the way that we've imagined it is, imagine a world where you design, deliver, and consume your digital world with the iRights framework in your mind. And the reason that we say it like that is because one of the divide and rule aspects around this issue, because there's a load of people doing really good work in here, mm-hmm. but is to divide, you know, data protection from questions of privacy or questions of harm from questions of access and so on. And we're saying this is a big picture. And that sounds like a roundabout way of answering your question, but it's really important because wherever you are in the food chain, you can ask yourself, am I consuming, am I delivering, or am I designing these rights for young people who interact with me in my piece of the digital world? So my point is, in tiny little ways that are technologically available right now, before you've even turned off this podcast, yeah?
Yeah.
And in very big ways that require some proper thinking, yeah, you can do something. So the first thing we do is we say agree, then we say audit, do what you can, then we say advocate. And what we're asking of everybody who joins iRights is please get 10 other organizations to join. Get 10 other groups of people who you think this should matter to actually sign up and do their 10. We're very old-fashioned. It's a waterfall. It's got to be viral. Sure. You've got to do it.
Well, that brings up a good question. If I am a content creator and I have a website where I post articles, is there something I can do to participate in this sort of holistic approach that you're advocating?
Absolutely. First of all, we would very much encourage you to sign up to iRights on the iRights webpage. We would then actually encourage you to blog about it, to say what you feel about it, to complain about the things you don't like, to celebrate what you do. And really, to be clear, and this is something that we've talked about a lot amongst our group, we do not deal with every single problem of the internet for young people, nor do we celebrate every single brilliant thing in it. What this is a framework by which people could reasonably expect to be taking care of a part of the community for whom we have accepted a duty of care. Mm. And to allow a greater possibility of positive and, as Guy said, creative engagement.
So, Guy, what are the next steps for you folks now?
I think the next steps is to sign, you know, I think partly you're building a broad framework and you want to be as inclusive as possible because, again, you know, let's try and get tech companies, big businesses, small businesses, as well as, you know, all the youth-based organisations involved. And I think the other thing is, like, get people actually questioning what they have in terms of websites or apps or whatever else against those five rights and come up with ideas and suggestions for us, saying, well, actually, you know, just take the right to know. Okay.
When you talk about the right to know, can you maybe drill that down a little bit more? What is it that we have the right to know?
So I think we have the right to know just in kind of, I think kids have the right to know when they go to a site, for example, what data about themselves is being used
and what
how
it's being used for.
And what it's being used for, right? We're not saying don't do it or anything like that. It's just like, and we're not even saying there's a silver bullet, right? It's about...
The child has the right to be an informed consumer as well as
absolutely.
Anybody.
Absolutely, yeah. Just rather than being passive mm-hmm. and kind of something being done to them, their right to know. And actually that could produce a positive outcome for whoever owns the website, you know, which is also good. And if you can crack that issue, which is what we're saying, then actually you're going to provide a framework for kids, which is far better than it maybe is now.
So I explained the right to know in a school the other day, and a kid said to me, "So, Miss, what you're saying is that you don't mind if Nike knows that I prefer Nike shoes to the other kind of shoes, but when I Google for anal warts, I might like to keep that private." And that was, and I went, beautifully put, my friend. I shall be using that in the future. And it's not what I care about. I don't care about whether he wants to share about anal warts either.
But he has the right to absolutely conduct a private search or to know whether or not his access to data will be protected.
Yeah, and that's sort of obviously emblematic. But I do think, you know, levels of visibility.
There are some websites and apps which actually implement really good practice. And I think part of that is some of those people actually being vocal and say, hey, we built this brilliant thing. Hey, and everyone else can use it, right? And here's some really good practice we found which prevents bullying. Well, why doesn't everyone else use this great research we have? It's that sort of thing we're after.
Yeah. Actually, that's a really good point. It's that, you know, one of the things is, you know, you leave the house and you look, you tell the kid, please cross on a zebra crossing or the green man. Well, those are two things that kids can recognize on every street. Mm. And I think that Guy's point about there's a lot of good practice, which is not recognizable. It's not common to all. And actually, if you didn't know that if it wasn't a zebra, if it was blue on one street and yellow on the other and a pink dot on the third, it's very difficult to get a handle on a norm. So I think that as technology is creating new norms, we're saying let's have a few commonly held, broad-based principles.
Like safety signs.
Like safety signs, like how to get there quicker, like, you know, I mean, just things, they're not all about protection. It's about, you know, I think that what we're saying is there's been a very big political argument about access. We're saying make sure it's quality access. We want quality access for young people so they're not sort of kicked out of the game before they even get to their maturity. And I think that we have to really accept now that this technology we don't just use it, it shapes us. And so the method of our use is actually impinging on who we are. This bunch have used it since they were conscious, and therefore it's shaping them. So we just got to have a few rules of engagement that we can all say, do you know what? Let's treat them with respect. It's a rights, responsibility, resilience, and respect. That's what it's about.
Well, that sounds brilliant to me. Where can listeners go to get more information or to participate?
iRights.uk.
That's all we have for you this week. A big thanks to my guests, Bevan Kidron and Guy Fernando. Also to the tech team, Charles Arthur, Alex Hearn, and Samuel Gibbs. I'm Lee Alexander, and Tech Weekly is produced by Jason Phipps. Thanks for listening, and do join us next week. Bye.
For more great downloads, go to theguardian.com/audio.